Depending on your political leanings, the outcome of the 2016 presidential election was either a thrilling victory or a massive shock. Donald Trump was in many ways the dark horse candidate to both clinch the GOP nomination and then beat Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. So for Democrats, the election of Donald Trump was a big setback. For Republicans, the win was a mixed bag, which led to serious changes in the party. Our next guest has been covering the Republican Party for years and recently wrote a book about the impact President Trump has had on the GOP. Tim Alberta is chief political correspondent for Politico. He's the author of the book American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I want to start close to home, Tim, in Wisconsin. Former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was a front runner at one point when he entered the 2016 presidential race. He ended his candidacy, and I want to give a listen to some of what he had to say at the announcement that his candidacy was ending.
I believe that I'm being called to lead by helping to clear the field in this race so that a positive conservative message can rise to the top of the field. With this in mind, I will suspend my campaign immediately. I encourage other Republican presidential candidates to consider doing the same so that the voters can focus on a limited number of candidates who can offer a positive conservative alternative to the current frontrunner. This is fundamentally important to the future of the party and, more importantly, to the future of our country.
That frontrunner at the time was Donald Trump, and now Scott Walker will be chair of Trump's reelection effort in Wisconsin. One example of something a lot of people went through, I think, Tim, before and after. Can you talk about that change in the Republican Party?
Yeah, the stages of grief, as it would relate to Donald Trump and his relationship with the Republican Party. You used the phrase before and after, which I think is a good way to think about it. You know, if you see a weight loss commercial or a hair restoration commercial, they have those before and after pictures. And I think in a lot of ways, what you have is a before and after picture of a lot of these prominent Republicans, such as Scott Walker, Paul Ryan, Lindsey Graham, the list goes on and on. People who felt one way very clearly and very outspokenly about Donald Trump during his ascent, felt that he was an existential threat to the party, to the country. People went so far as to call him a cancer, like Rick Perry, who of course later became a member of his cabinet. And then of course you have these after pictures when all of these folks suddenly found religion on Donald Trump and realized not only that they could, you know, grin and bear it and that they could hold their nose and go along with his takeover of the party, but would begin to sing a completely different song, at least publicly, telling anybody who would listen that really he is a conservative, that really he is a positive, aspirational, forward-thinking, generational leader who we all should be rallying behind. It's just that we're all missing it. And you know, to see such a sharp 180 taken by so many of these Republican figures obviously prompts a series of questions, and at the heart of them is, you know, why are these folks all feeling compelled to fall in line behind somebody who 24 months ago nobody supported, nobody thought was a conservative, nobody called a Republican? And obviously it's a fascinating psychological case study and clearly one of the great political questions of our generation.
And you write that in many years, Donald Trump would not have been a successful Republican candidate, but he came at the right time in the midst of what you say in the title of your book was a Republican Civil War, right? Pre-Donald Trump, what was this civil war within the Republican Party?
Well, look, go back to 2008. George W. Bush is leaving office with historically high disapproval ratings. The country and really the Republican Party in large part has turned on him and soured on his performance. You have the disastrous handling of Hurricane Katrina, of the Iraq War, rising debt and deficit, the Terry Schiavo, you name it. And there are these mounting crises facing the Bush administration. And then, of course, as he's preparing to leave office, who is nominated as their new Republican standard bearer? John McCain, someone who, while popular with the national media and seen as somebody who, you know, is a maverick and kind of a political crusader, and he's won favorable headlines throughout the years. This is certainly not somebody who has ever identified with the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And John McCain, realizing that he has almost no chance to win the election in 2008 against Barack Obama, he throws a Hail Mary. He knows that he has one chance to fire up the conservative base. And who is it? It's Sarah Palin, picking her as his vice presidential running mate. And between Bush leaving office, as unpopular as he was, between McCain's pick of Sarah Palin and how he had exposed this real schism that had been brewing between sort of the elite intellectual wing of the Republican Party, the country club GOP, and the downscale blue-collar working-class Republican base. And then, of course, that fall, finally, you have the financial collapse and you have the bank bailouts and you have millions of Americans feeling as though Washington is rigging this system against them, that they're playing by a completely different set of rules than everyday Americans. And so this whole thing is a powder keg politically and culturally and socioeconomically inside the Republican Party. And it begins to really explode when Bush leaves office. And you have the Tea Party, you have the likes of Ted Cruz and his sort of revolutionaries coming to Washington. And we can see that all the while, there is this wave building and building and beginning to swallow up the old Republican establishment. We just didn't know ultimately who was going to ride that wave. But when Donald Trump came along and he rode down that golden escalator in Trump Tower, he was proverbially the man meeting the moment. He stepped into a political atmosphere that was absolutely perfect and ripe for his ascent.
Were there particular issues that Republicans, maybe rank and file Republicans, had lost faith with the establishment leaders on, and they were waiting for someone, whether it was Ted Cruz or somebody beyond him, to step into that void?
Oh, sure. I think you would start with immigration. I think that there was a real sense of disillusionment among conservatives who felt as though, you know, George W. Bush was trying to sell the party out on immigration. John McCain, his successor, obviously becoming the party's new leader in 2008 as a nominee, that he was very liberal, had been liberal for decades on the issue of immigration. Mitt Romney in 2012 sort of tried to talk tough on immigration, but this is a business guy, and this is somebody who, you know, was very much identified with the pro-immigration wing of the party. So when Donald Trump came along and started making these big promises and started using this very tough and hostile and obviously nativist language about immigrants, that was something that really captured some not insignificant portion of the Republican electorate and really spoke to these pent-up feelings of frustration that had been simmering on the right for many years. Obviously, Trump also coming along and talk about exposing a schism. I talked about how Sarah Palin did that to a certain extent, and that was largely cultural, speaking to this disconnect between, you know, the elites and the everyday American. What Donald Trump really exposed was a disconnect that was both cultural but also policy-driven. I mean, Trump understood at a gut level that many Republican voters did not share the elite Republican opinion on an issue like immigration or on an issue like trade, where Donald Trump was the one person standing on that stage surrounded by free traders in the Republican primary, basically threatening to start a trade war with China and slap tariffs on incoming goods from other countries. That is something, it's hard to fully appreciate it because all of this has happened so quickly, but that's something that for the last 30 years would have gotten you thrown out of the Republican Party. It was just so alien to hear somebody on the presidential debate stage advocating that kind of position on trade. And yet what Donald Trump understood, again, is that for a lot of conservative blue-collar voters across middle America who felt that they had watched their livelihoods and their communities ravaged by these free trade agreements, they were ready for a change. They were ready to disrupt the status quo. They were no longer interested in the Wall Street Journal editorial page view on issues like trade and like immigration. And here comes Donald Trump sort of ramming at the gates of the establishment in a way that these folks have been craving for years. And I think even more than Ted Cruz, Trump was able and really prescient in identifying those sentiments and tapping into them.
Talking to Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico. We're talking about his book, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. Before we bring on a caller, Tim, I want to bring on another Wisconsin recurring character in your book, former House Speaker Paul Ryan. He was, pro-free trade. He had to work with President Trump. He had described one of President Trump's comments as the textbook definition of racism. He had a lot of objections to President Trump, and yet he ended up working with him. You talked to Paul Ryan in the research for your book. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, yeah, and of course, Ryan is someone who was fiercely critical of Trump during his rise in 2015 and 2016, and then essentially went radio silent in criticizing Trump during their 2 years serving together, Trump as the president, Ryan as the speaker in this unified Republican government. And that was because Ryan had made the calculation, whether you agree with it or not, that he had made the calculation that, look, if I'm going to get anything done with this guy, he's extremely thin-skinned, he's very sensitive to criticism, he's insecure. And if I'm out there launching broadsides and calling him out and criticizing his behavior or his rhetoric, you know, I'm not going to be able to get anything done with him. I need to try and exert influence on him quietly from the inside in order to both get things accomplished in government and also try to keep them from his own worst instincts. That was the calculus that Ryan made. And, of course, he pursued that strategy with varying degrees of success for about 2 years. And then when Ryan left the speakership, the first real interview that he gave afterwards was with me for the book, and he sat down and kind of let it fly and was suddenly the old Paul Ryan again, where he was not at all shy about criticizing Trump, about speaking very candidly about just how how disconcerting he found the president's behavior to be, how uncomfortable he was with much of his rhetoric, and really obviously opened himself up to a lot of criticism himself from a lot of people who were wondering, geez, where was this the last, you know, two and a half years? And again, Ryan, a very, very mercurial figure in this book and in the story of the modern Republican Party, has sort of been on both sides of the Trump phenomenon and has elicited no shortage of hatred, and no matter which side of it he's come down on.
Let's bring on a caller now. Pat is with us in Troy. Pat, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment. I recently became a registered Republican, but I was more or less an independent for the longest time. And I did vote for Trump, although I do not like Trump, and I have never liked him, and I still don't like him. I think he's arrogant. But I felt we needed a businessman and someone who could run the company and stop competing with slave labor, which is China and Mexico. And I felt Trump could do it, and I've been very pleased with what he's done. And because of that, I'll vote for him again.
Pat, thanks for the call. And Tim, I think Pat matches a lot of polls that were out there. There were a lot of people who didn't like Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, but a lot of people who didn't like Donald Trump still found ways to vote for him. And according to Pat, at least she will again.
Yeah, look, there was a huge body of research to show us in late 2016 that Donald Trump was winning the votes of a lot of people who either didn't like him or didn't think he was qualified to be president, or both. And that's a pretty phenomenal thing in American politics. You don't often see large numbers of voters telling pollsters that they're going to support a candidate who they don't like and they don't think should be in the office. And obviously much of that spoke to the discontent with Hillary Clinton as his opponent on the Democratic side. But let's be honest, I mean, I think a lot of it also just speaks to the general discontent with the political status quo that a lot of Americans are feeling, where they looked around, felt like government was broken and that they needed to, you know, send a wrecking ball into Washington, and Donald Trump was that wrecking ball. And you don't have to like the wrecking ball necessarily, but that was the mentality a lot of voters had. And at this point, despite the fact that he continues to offend and bother a lot of voters, for lack of a better way of putting it, obviously, there are still an awful lot of voters who voted for him in 2016 reluctantly, who told pollsters that they're still leaning toward voting for him again.
Thanks for that call, Pat, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Tim Alberta from Politico. His new book is American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Let's bring on another caller now. Larry is with us in Appleton. Larry, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Larry?
Well, I think that the author gives Trump too much credit. I don't think that he's intellectually capable of having anticipated and figured this out. I think he just happened to come along when there was a level of discontent, but I think more significantly, a level of irresponsibility on the part of the American electorate. I'm 75 and I've lived through the best of times, so I don't mean to be too hard on the electorate, the younger electorate. I feel sorry for them, really, but they really have to stop being selfish and irresponsible. Voting for someone that you don't like doesn't make any sense.
Larry, thanks a lot for the call. I want to give Tim a chance to jump in. So part one of Larry's comment there, Trump is not playing, in effect, eight-dimensional chess or whatever people are saying. He just hit the right place at the right time, Tim.
Well, look, I think there are two oversimplifications of Trump. One is that he's playing eight-dimensional chess and he's always 10 moves ahead of everybody, and that there's just a strategic mastermind there that you can't see. And the other is that he's this fumbling idiot who just kind of wanders his way into success unwittingly. I think neither one is really true. Look, at the end of the day, you don't have to have some grand intellectual capacity or have read political science books to have a read on the electorate. I think what makes Trump so interesting is that despite living in, you know, a gilded penthouse on Fifth Avenue, this is somebody who for the last 20 years, even before running for president, you go back and read interviews with him that go back to the late 1980s, this is somebody who talked about the fact that the two major parties and the elites in the two major parties were selling out a lot of blue-collar working Americans on those issues of immigration and trade. If there's one thing Trump has been insistent on, it is speaking to those specific issues. So I don't necessarily agree that Trump just sort of lucked into this in 2016, but I do understand where Larry's coming from, which is to push back on this notion that Trump was somehow the man behind the curtain orchestrating all of this in a way that none of us simpletons could have understood. I also agree with him that the American electorate has become lazy and tribalized and polarized to a degree that is really harmful to this country's future, not even as it pertains to Trump specifically, but even as it pertains to Congress. When you look at the makeup of the federal government and who we send to Washington, that is a direct reflection on an electorate that has not been doing its job well.
All right, I want to spend at least our last few minutes, Tim, on what's going on now, what could be a post-epilogue to your book. As you wrapped up your book, there's like some talk like impeachment. No, that's too out there for the Democrats at that point. Well, now here we are. What do you make of all this?
Well, shoot. I mean, the president just keeps handing ammunition to the Democratic Party, practically begging them to come after him. And you know, there are quite a few Republicans close to the president who have told him and whispered in his ear more than once that impeachment is the best possible thing that could happen to him as far as mobilizing his base in 2020. That's not to say that the president is necessarily leaking these things himself or, again, that this is eight-dimensional chess, but the president is in a position now where a Republican base that has been somewhat fractured in its support of him, and you can look at public opinion polls to see that 9 out of 10 Republicans support him, but that doesn't account for lots of people who have been Republicans for 50 years who are now identifying as independent. The party itself is contracting under Trump. There's no question about that. The question really is, to what degree do Democrats not just galvanize and mobilize their own base with impeachment, but also galvanize and mobilize the Republican base to circle the wagons around Trump in a way that they might otherwise have not up until this point? I think that's sort of the danger for Democrats, but clearly they have crossed the Rubicon and feel as though there's no turning back.
And is there turning back for the Republican Party post-Donald Trump, whenever that is in his political career? Do things go back to the old ways for Republicans?
Oh, I doubt it. I don't think things go back to the old ways for either party. I think we are thoroughly through the looking glass as Americans at this point. When you think about the fact that 4 freshman Democratic congresswomen have more power than the Speaker of the House of Representatives, that is not a reflection of Donald Trump. It is a reflection of the current political ecosystem fueled by outside money and activism and social media. The playing field is so flat and so democratized at this point that the political establishment of both parties are basically neutered, and they just do not have the power, the authority to wield like they used to. And I think that that makes it a whole new ballgame, and it opens us up to an entirely different sort of government moving forward, a government that is far less traditional and far less orthodox in its conventions and in its institutions than it once was.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
It's Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico. He's the author of American Carnage: On the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump.